Welcome to the Brilliant Podcast. This is episode number 20. We live in a world where most stories are just variants of the same old story. Good beats evil, cowboys and Indians, profits and loss. This story has been told 1,000,000,000 times, and the ubiquity of it is what I would call a great tragedy. The Brilliant Podcast is an attempt to tell different kinds of stories, ones with complex moral plays, ones that aren't so clearly stories, and ones that are of human size. Our motivation to tell these tales is a desire to see a proliferation of different kinds of stories, and not just the simple morality plays of popular culture, or the inverted, but otherwise identical, stories of the radical milieu. We believe that a world of free people is possible. We call these people, the people who are in active pursuit of a free world, the people who are coming to be unto themselves, the brilliant, because they're impossible to ignore, and yet cannot be seen directly, especially in a world that is dull and gray. I'm your host, Aragorn, joined by co-host Bellamy, and in the background, our sound engineer, Roy Burton.
And this is episode 20 of The Brilliant. We have reached a bi-deca state, and I guess a moment of retrospection is in order. We've reached a point of having pretty steady engagement with the episodes, steady in both positive and negative feedback, which is nice. And I think this episode we're going to start with some listener feedback, a few engagements people had with us, and then move on to answering a question of why are we, the anarchist population of the world, so weak and so unpopular?
Yeah, I also, we're going to talk a little bit about some news stories that have come down the pipe. In particular, there was an announcement just, I guess, in the past few days of a brand new Kickstarter campaign to start a new anarchist media project, which would be a slick magazine version, I guess even with full color cover, and maybe even some of the inside of the brand new website It's Going Down, which we haven't talked very much about, and that's mostly because, to my eye, it's hard to engage with a website that doesn't... that's sort of as just a series of declarations. For me, the lack of comments is kind of a deal. But a lot of our young friends, hipper, more beautiful, appear to be totally on board with the It's Going Down project. And specifically, like, the Crime Think podcast gave, like, several shout-outs to how fantastic It's Going Down is in terms of being a brand new anarchist news source. And they even gave... the people who originated the website 10 minutes just to sort of talk about what their project is and their analysis of 2015. And so now they're expanding into a magazine. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I guess I'm curious. I didn't listen to the Crime Think bit myself. Did they... give a sort of statement of intention about what was distinct about their media project as opposed to other ones? We spent a little bit of time, I think, 2 weeks ago talking about how, you know, sometimes you get this sort of very critical, out-of-hand dismissal coming in response to new media projects that often goes something like, why do we need another media project? What we need is action, not more people talking about things. And you and I spent a bit of time unpacking that and talking about how different different anarchist media projects have very different takes and seem to be created for very different purposes and have very different structures. Did they talk about what motivated them to do something like that?
No, but I think the proof or the answer to that question lies in the website itself. I think that what's interesting is that the title, or as in title tag, of the It's Going Down website describes itself as anarchist news and practice. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the content itself, like if you were to just look at the headlines of, let's say, 20 stories from It's Going Down, probably somewhere in the 8 to 12 range out of those 20 would not have an A word in the title.
Yeah. Getting excited about social struggles that are emerging.
Yeah.
They anarchist or liberal.
Well, I mean, their interest is obviously in something that looks a bit more explicitly revolutionary than a lot of anarchist, especially media projects, are. And obviously that looks a little bit more, or a little bit less white. I would say that It's Going Down, you know, in a different time we would say it has a fetishistic approach towards people of color struggles, but I'll be more generous and say that, you know, they have a concern, as anyone should, that radical struggles that call themselves anarchists tend to be lily white. And so in that regard, they're definitely devoting a lot of time to struggles that people of color are doing. Yeah.
It's interesting calling it practice. I mean, the practice aspects, it could be taken a lot of different ways. It could be this sort of suggestion that the people behind the project themselves are actively engaged in these sorts of things. They could be trying to say that the media itself is practice, which, I mean, there's an argument for that. I do find myself, I guess, wondering about that kind of fetishization would be the ungenerous way of talking about it, as you said, because it seems to speak of, there's something a mutual friend of ours said to me a week ago that I appreciated, that anarchists have a hammer nail problem. That is, when you get really stuck on holding the hammer, everything looks like a nail, and that when you get really attached to the riot, then anything that looks like a riot then looks good, and anytime when you're thinking how can we move towards something good, then you're saying how can we foment a riot.
Well, I do think it's appropriate to at least pause on the fact that It's Going Down does seem to be a very reactive project to anarchist news. I mentioned the comments already, as in the lack of comments from It's Going Down, but the other thing that seems to be in strong reaction is this idea of theory and practice, because of their focus on the riot forum, which I think it's apparent that they're...
I mean, the Kickstarter video is...
It's nothing but riots, yeah. But I think that they're saying very explicitly, like, whereas anarchist news represents anarchist self-marginalization, we represent practical anarchism on the streets and in the on the reservation and, you know, in the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to do that kind of brush or tarring with a brush, because there's no doubt that anarchist news, some of the sort of prominent personalities that speak there a lot do take the role of the critic, you know, the person who's dissatisfied with almost everything that people are doing. And if your whole orientation is positivistic and says the more that people are openly displaying anger at the system, the better, and that it's a matter of sort of flipping a certain number of human beings into the riot form and then we will win, then...
Well, let's actually be generous and let them speak for themselves. The idea for It's Going Down developed out of conversations about the need for a high-quality news site that was accessible to the public and also a tool and resource for those already involved in revolutionary social struggles.
Yeah, a few things jump out there. Accessible to the public. What does that mean?
I think beautiful web design and... I mean, you know, I guess let's just look at the site.
I mean, like one thing that jumped out to me in the video, they said that their objective is to get the magazine into every info shop. That to me doesn't say accessible to the public. I mean, that says accessible to the milieu.
So the three pretty picture headlines include an article on Trump, they're against. I guess a column called Block Party that basically talks about how cool they are and how basically you can't hang out with them because they're really cool. And then the third being the link to their Kickstarter that talks about, yeah, whatever, their print publication and the vision for it. And, you know, and again...
You're talking about Trump, to be fair, that's fucking popular. I mean, the guy, it's got to be one of the top fucking trending things on Google
every
other week. So, yeah, I guess if you want to reach out to the public, you can talk about how Trump is bad.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm seeing the top 12 stories. One of them is explicitly anarchist. And a couple of them are vaguely anarchist. So they call themselves anarchists in a very different sense. And actually, the website itself doesn't even have the A word on it, whereas I think the paper does. Mm-hmm. So probably what we're seeing is that even in the context of their self-organization, they probably have a different faction that's going to do this print publication that will very much, I think, be for the milieu. And that's a different faction than the ones that actually do this.
Yeah, front page. So it's Daily News of Revolt. Revolt being the key word rather than anarchist.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, a couple minutes ago you said, let's be generous, and I feel like we're veering into ungenerous territory. Yeah. So to take it generously, I think my response would be to say, this is absolutely speaking to a different tendency of anarchism, one that has been present for a long time, and, you know, rather than... saying it sucks for X, Y, and Z reasons, I would just say this is not my understanding of anarchism. My understanding of anarchism is not how do we foment a riot, and if the riot happens, the riot is good. My tendency of anarchism is not to say that most people in the world latently agree with me. They just don't realize it yet. I'm not convinced that that's the case. I'm not convinced that most people are anarchists and they just need to have their consciousness awakened. And I think that's sort of where this comes from.
Another news story we wanted to talk about was this this howler that comes from Strike magazine, which is a propaganda unit out of the UK. They do some interesting postering campaigns and whatnot, but this howler is sort of worth talking about. It's called Notes Towards a Theory of the Manarchist, and it basically is a poll where you can. A quiz that you complete the quiz, and depending on your score, they basically tell you how much of a manarchist you are.
If you want a boxer, I will step into the ring for you. And if you want a doctor, I'll examine every inch of you. If you want a driver, climb inside. Or if you want to take me for a ride, you know you can. I'm your man.
And this harkens back to the sort of the original conversations around manarchism, which was... at least 10 years ago, maybe more like 15, out of Eugene.
I didn't know it was that old.
Yeah, out of Eugene, Oregon, and specifically out of the eco-anarchist scene.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so the original critique was very much about, like, tree sits and things like that. And so it's funny to see it in this sort of new form, because, of course, at this point, there's so much more, like, cultural resonance behind the manarchist terminology. But, yeah, what were your thoughts about this? Was this the first time you'd ever heard the term? Or?
No, it wasn't the first time that I'd ever heard the term. I didn't know it went back that far. I guess it's not really that surprising. And so just to briefly engage with it, it describes a sort of caricature of a white male activist sort of person who is, you know, throwing lots of time and effort into social struggles, and is charismatic and likes to be in sort of a leadership or media attention position, and at the same time is domineering in discussions and predatory sexually, and, you know, is every kind of nasty person that embodies sort of the over-entitled man. And yeah, my reaction, I mean, I actually went so far as to wade into the comment section, was sort of, is this news, I guess? I mean, it's not surprising to me that that sort of personality type, and, you know, I would say, I don't know that there's a human being that actually embodies this full caricature, but, you know, it's pointing at something. And it, to me, it's not really surprising that the sort of activist, leftist social struggle culture would attract that kind of personality type, because it is the loyal opposition. Often, structurally, it's not entirely different from the system that it claims to oppose. It tends to be based on hierarchy, tends to be based on charismatic leadership. And so it's not surprising to me that just as the state and various police forces are actually have been psychologically demonstrated to attract a sociopathic personality type, and in some cases, like the CIA, actually actively recruit that personality type, it's not surprising that a shitty human being would be attracted to activist culture, where you can get lots of attention, you're surrounded by all sorts of young, passionate women, and that you would leverage the kind of power that you have into being predatory. At the same time, I know that where this sort of critique is coming from is an orientation that I don't like, which is a sort of leftist fetishizing egalitarianism sort of position that wants to spend a lot of time talking about how we can get sort of equal representation into various structural bodies, and it tends to be more interested in sort of evening the playing field or redistributing the wealth rather than working towards something that's actually a break with civilization.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not passionate about this topic. I guess mostly because...
You're saying you don't want to engage with it to the degree that I just did?
No, I'm feeling your passion. I guess when this first came around, I guess I felt a lot closer to the people who were doing the accusing.
Mm, sure.
And at this point, I don't feel very, very close to the people who do this sort of, like, shouting.
Like, in your analysis, or in your...
No, I would say that in the last 10 years, I've successfully migrated my social circle into grown-ups, rather than the kind of name-calling politics that this represents. That said, there is a way in which this article exemplifies an effort by young women to educate men on how to be different. But of course, because educating stupid men about how to be different is a waste of time, instead it comes off like this. In other words, it comes off as accusations and name calling and sort of like a not so subtle fuck you. So I don't envy the writers or the people who sort of have these concerns, because they're going to fail. Mm-hmm. And in other words, there's no way in which this project, like let's say that there are 10 men that are in mind of the people who were writing this quiz as they were writing it up. I don't envy the fact that people devote their energy so much to a group of people they don't like that they hate or that they're against or that they feel sort of are imposing themselves upon them, you know. Or to put it a different way, I think that this is an interesting approach to the problem of quote-unquote patriarchy, right? So if we're going to talk about patriarchy and how do we end patriarchy, one way in which, you know, arguably many feminists would say is that you basically shout at people until they hear you. And so the question would be, is that patriarchy? Is the
shouting at someone until you hear?
Well, no, the people who are being shouted at. Mm-hmm. Like the young men who are being attacked in this article, let's just call them for a minute, the patriarchy as one can see it in their daily life. How does one end that? How does one stop that? And so traditionally, in radical lefty circles, you know, the ways in which you end that is you either shout until you're heard, you remove yourself, a la lesbian separatists or whatnot, and you know, what are third ways? The third ways you look like different forms of negotiation, And sometimes maybe even explicit segregation.
Yeah, I would say also trying to defame someone to the point that they exit whatever mm-hmm. social circle that you're in.
But this manarchist thing is a step towards that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, there's nobody who I've ever seen chased out of a scene who isn't called a whole bunch of names like manarchist.
Sure, sure.
When that happens. So to me, this is interesting just because it's a way for us to sort of, like, reflect on what successes and failures have happened by way of the sort of big language that we use when we talk about what an anarchist is. In other words, in general, we say an anarchist is someone who's against patriarchy. And so in that context, talking about a manarchist, an anarchist who's not against the patriarchy and in fact embraces it, there's a reasonable discussion to have there. I would, of course, take it in a really different direction than this takes it in, because I basically think that we use these big, loaded terms to demonstrate our failure of imagination. This is my personal opinion. But you know, again, because I don't feel particularly implicated by this document, I don't know the people who wrote it, and more importantly, I'm, you know, at least 10 years removed from, like, feeling like it's all about me. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, I think a different perspective to put on it for me is, if you remove the patriarchy analysis from it, what you're left with is saying, what do we do about toxic people?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that question becomes maybe less complicated when you say that, because my experience from being around lots of toxic people in my life is, you can try to argue with them, you can try to appeal to them, you can try to accuse them, you can try to show them their behavior, and the vast majority of the time, it's not going to work, because there's a certain narcissistic mind that just is infinitely able to evade or redirect or claim that they believe you, and then the next day do the same shit. And my experience has been, the best thing you can do with toxic people is just fucking avoid them. And I'm not part of the sort of big tent anarchist analysis that says we need to, like, find a place for everyone and embrace everyone and rehabilitate everyone. I'm fine with just avoiding some people.
Amen.
Okay, so let's do some listener feedback. Someone messaged us with something that was hilarious, and I never thought I would see the day that I would hear free market and existentialists applying to the same person. So someone named William Irwin, who's a philosophy professor at Pennsylvania's King's College, says that he is one of the loneliest people on the planet because, quote, "I'm the only one in academic philosophy who both identifies as an existentialist and as a libertarian."
Just me only, sitting on my little throne. I work very hard and make up great plans, but nobody listens, no one understands. Seems right no one takes me seriously, and so I'm lonely. A little lonely. Poor little me.
Well, let's give a little bit more of a context here. So we're sent to URL, it's on YouTube, and it's from Reason.org,
right.
Reason.com, whatever, Reason Magazine.
Yeah.
And Reason Magazine, for those of you who don't know, it's like the libertarian magazine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And so they then interview this cat, William Irwin, and now continue.
Well, I think it totally makes sense for Reason to do this sort of thing, because it's a way for them to try to take a rich philosophical tradition away from the leftists. So this William Irwin person wrote "The Free Market Existentialist: Capitalism Without Consumerism," which sounds interesting in itself. And in the interview, which is only about, I think, 6 or 7 minutes long, and it's kind of funny, so I encourage anyone to check it out. He argues that it's only a coincidence that existentialism is associated with the left. It just happened to be the people at the time. And he says existentialism has as much to do with communism as cigarettes have to do with existentialism. And he notes that Sartre early on was pretty much apolitical and very much focused on the individual, and it was only later that he became more interested in social struggles and, you know, made some questionable political choices, for sure. And his sort of way out of consumerism is to say that consumerism consists of buying unmindfully and finding one's worth and signaling one's worth by buying, and that what is possible is a capitalism that is mindful, that is not so much about the accumulation of stuff, and that in this one could find the existential freedom to, you know, define themselves and find their own individual meaning and value. And when asked what his interest in libertarianism was, he talked about how he initially was just an existentialist, and then as he started to pay a little bit more attention to politics and he expressed a distaste for politics, he said that he recognized that libertarianism was for him because, quote, "I like to be left alone. I don't want to be told how to live," end quote. And to me, it was interesting on a few levels. First, the idea that somehow the existentialist, you know, eternal quest in the darkness for meaning could somehow find that meaning in a world that's based fundamentally on producing commodities and exchanging commodities. And even if you say, "I'm not going to fetishize these commodities to the degree that we do now," it's still a society that's based on making stuff and selling stuff. And that anywhere in there is the room to have a human life, to me, is just really, on the face of it, hard to believe. And the second thing that, which this is the thing that always rankles me, which is the way, of course, that libertarians try to take the idea of freedom, you know, capital F, away from anarchists, or sort of act like anarchism doesn't exist.
Well, their boogeyman is a Marxist, not an anarchist.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But go on.
Yeah, but I think that one of the most effective ways that libertarians argue for their position is to act like anarchism doesn't exist. And it's, you know, do you want this, you know, statist society that with a command economy that forces everyone to be equal, or do you want individuality? Well, when you put it that way. And yeah, that I think it would be interesting to do an episode on libertarianism sometime in the future. Yeah, if you act like that's the only system in which the individual is left alone, and that there wouldn't be more room for the individual to be left alone in something like an anti-civ anarchist world, then you have a very effective line of argument. And if you ignore all the complications with your position, the chief among them being, how do you decide original claims to property, and how do you do that in a way that isn't going to instantly create tremendous inequality and put some people in a position to more or less enslave others, then you have a very effective line of argument. And I mean, I could get into it more, but we should save it for maybe an episode on libertarianism.
Yeah, I guess the reason that this person sent this to us is because, you know, it's an example of someone who is a market-inclined person who is also talking about French philosophers that we like. But I think mostly they were talking to you. I mean, you seem to attract the libertarian audience much more than I do.
I don't think this person was libertarian. I think it was more like, hey, look, this is strange, but
I just attract haters. But I mean, for me, the most interesting thing I did watch the video was this very sneaky definition of consumerism that basically acted like the situationist didn't exist.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I mean, you already talked about it, but just the person referred to themselves as being a mindful consumer, which, you know, if this person were a liberal, we would be pointing and laughing because of all the ridiculous ways in which that sounds as a liberal. And
like a sustainability kind of person.
Yeah, but really, he was making no different of an argument. He was basically saying that market relationships are okay as long as you're mindful. Well, that just means that you believe in good intentions. Mm-hmm. And whether you're a libertarian or a liberal, I think that that's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's also the old canard of, if I do the right thing, somehow it's going to ripple outward and other people are going to do the right thing too. I mean, you can imagine a world that's a market world where it's a lot less toxic and there's a lot less production. And you can say to yourself, well, if I only buy what I really need, then I'm going to be the good person and that's going to ripple outward. But that's not really how human social relations work.
Yeah, and people of this inclination tend to point out the ridiculousness of utopian left arguments that make the exact same case.
Sure.
They point out how silly they are in droves, but somehow miss it in their own argumentation. But I will say that, you know, to prefigure whatever conversation we'll have about libertarians, really, the conversation about anarcho-communists would be very similar to a conversation about libertarians, which is that I think strongly, I believe, that talking about the economics of an after-the-revolutionary society, it's great from the perspective of talking about fantasies and talking about the sort of your ideal world, but it's a fantasy. It has almost nothing to do with what the conversations would look like after the revolution. In other words, before the Bolshevik Revolution, nobody would have ever imagined war communism.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So we had another interesting email, and this was from the very same person whose email we talked about a while ago, who was asking us, I wish I knew which episode it was, maybe we could put that in the notes, but it was a person who asked us sort of, why have you given up on the idea of revolution, and isn't the sort of stuff that you're talking about in place of that lofty idea just sort of paltry crap? Actually, it was the episode Your Joy is So Bourgeois was the episode where we talked about this originally. And so the email's fairly long, and it includes a story about Greece that I don't know is directly related to the question. So I'm just going to read a bit of it here. And so this person was basically saying, hey, I appreciated your response, and now I want to engage with your response. Yeah. And they say, in your responses, Bellamy said that he never thinks of his activity in terms of strategy, and that it's possible to think in terms of partial changes that fall short of total transformation but are not necessarily reforms in the bad sense. Aragorn proposed that the question of revolution needs to be addressed by telling better stories, which were more rooted in indigenous conditions. It seems to me that one can quite concretely consider public interventions regarding the stories people tell in terms of strategy. Let me use an, quote, indigenous example from the U.S. And so they, I don't know, do you want to read this whole thing, or should we?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. After discussing the French anti-CPE movement, the authors of Communique from an Absent Future, one of the best texts to emerge from the university occupations in California during 2009, mention, quote, the Greek uprising of December 2008, end quote, which they say, quote, broke through many of the limits, end quote, of the French movement, and here's a big quote from the text that he's talking about, marked the beginning of a new cycle of class struggle. Initiated by students in response to the murder of an Athens youth by police, the uprising consisted of weeks of rioting, looting, and occupations of universities, union offices, and television stations. Entire financial and shopping districts burned, and what the movement lacked in numbers, it made up in its geographical breadth, spreading from city to city to encompass the whole of Greece. As in France, it was an uprising of youth, for whom the economic crisis represented a total negation of the future. Students, precarious workers, and immigrants were the protagonists, and they were able to achieve a level of unity that far surpassed the fragile solidarities of the anti-CPE movement. Just as significantly, they made almost no demands. While, of course, some demonstrators sought to reform the police system or to critique specific government policies, in general, they asked for nothing at all from the government, the university, the workplaces, or the police. Not because they considered this a better strategy, but because they wanted nothing that any of these institutions could offer. Here, content aligned with form, whereas the optimistic slogans that appeared everywhere in French demonstrations jarred with the images of burning cars and broken glass, in Greece, the rioting was the obvious means to begin to enact the destruction of an entire political and economic system. Ultimately, the dynamics that created the uprising also established its limit. It was made possible by the existence of a sizable radical infrastructure in urban areas, in particular the Exarchia neighborhood in Athens. The squats, bars, cafes, and social centers, frequented by students and immigrant youth, created the milieu.
We can wrap it up.
All right, so the key thing is about the infrastructure. And then this writer goes on to say, okay, so if infrastructure did play the role that the authors are claiming, so then how might we transcend that limit? And they suggest that this is something we would like because it's about like-minded individuals who know each other face-to-face, developed radical infrastructure, which is something we talk about,
and they refused traditional revolution. It was based on immediate desire, and so it seems like something that the Brilliant would like. So how do you see that this praxis that you propose, and whose contradictory consequences were played out in Greece, moving from a marginal milieu into the everyday lives of most slaves? How can separation between the stories told by participants of this milieu and the majority of proletarians be overcome? And then they go on to say that one of the limits might have been anarchists and working class people not talking to each other. Do we think that that's true in the U.S.? Does it even make a difference? So, big questions.
I mean, I guess the place that I would begin is to say that the moralism of the American context as compared to Greece is really worth reflecting on. So as an example, in the U.S. context, you can't start It's Going Down without basically the rallying cry of this new news project being Fuck Anarchist News. In other words, I just received a fundraising letter for people who want to start a bar, basically a bar in downtown Oakland, and they want to fundraise $60,000 to make it happen. And so, on the one hand, these people want to do this thing, and they need $60,000 to do it. And when they think about mechanisms to come up with that much money in their tool chest, is a fundraising letter to basically other broke people who they think maybe have someone
like $100.
Sure. Yeah. Right. So that's on the one hand, and obviously we're going to talk about this in more detail after we finish addressing this question. But the way that I would put this is that it is absolutely connected, the fact that we are so weak, in other words, that we have so few resources, we have so few intergenerational resources, and we build so little. Mm-hmm. And partially this is because the way in which we build things, we embed these intense moralisms. Another example would be to talk about the Long Haul, which is this, 30-year running radical info shop in the East Bay.
You could say on its own is a success, an aspect of success.
Absolutely successful.
Yeah.
But pretty much anybody who's been a radical for less than 10 years almost has never even visited the space, because they basically say it's shitty, it's not cool, and it has too many homeless people.
And it's run by a bunch of old people from a previous radical generation that don't understand our values.
Right. And so then and then 10 blocks away, not even 10 blocks away, is this brand new social center called the Omni, which is barely a social center. It self-describes as being an umbrella building for social justice organizations and art collectives. And so it's a far less explicitly political project, and basically its origins involved actually throwing an event at the Long Haul its origin story basically involves acting as though there is nothing else happening in the area. And to me, this, these are Bay Area stories, but they exemplify this way in which people find excruciatingly small political points to decide to not work with each other. Or perhaps to say it differently, it seems to be a high value for a lot of radicals to not deal with the generation that came before. Mm-hmm. And
is this what you mean? You said embedding moralisms into the infrastructure. Is this what you mean? That sort of drawing these lines of...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think, again, when people talk to each other about these things, they talk about them as being these sort of cataclysmic political disagreements, when in fact they're, I don't want to deal with somebody who thinks that wingnut is a term of affection, or who's into bicycle politics, or who's into veganism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, instead, I want to talk to people who say that they want, you know, to organize, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that obviously answers only sort of half the, this question.
Yeah.
And the other half of this question is, like, where does the lack, like, there's something about lack of interest here?
Yeah. So I guess just to parse it a little more clearly, mm-hmm. I would say what you were talking about with these sort of small differences, and I would say like maybe one of the more significant substantive differences that still shouldn't be a difference on its own of, you know, I don't want to talk to you. It's something like, do you support people of color social struggles against police brutality, or do you think like, oh, that's not really going anywhere that is exciting in an anarchist direction for me, would be one of the biggest sticking points. And yet what we're really talking about is almost like a strategic question. It's not even really a question of values necessarily. It's a strategic question that should be something that can be talked about. And instead it's an absolute wedge for mm-hmm. most people. And so that's maybe a way of parsing this question of, do you find this lack of interest to be true in the U.S. that anarchists and you know, people in social struggles don't want to talk to each other? Yes. Yeah. And it's because it's more about condemning the human being rather than addressing the strategic question.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure where you're going with this, but just to use the language that they use. How can separation between the stories told by participants of this milieu and the majority of proletarians be overcome? I have no idea. I mean, that's the question asked. And how can the separation between pro-revolutionaries and revolutionaries, or pro-revolutionaries and the bulk of society, be overcome? Probably it can't be. Or if we were going to talk about the strategies in which that division could be overcome, probably high on the list, and again, we're talking about the U.S. context, would be someone making a TV show. And successfully navigating the most effective storytelling medium in North America. So, you know, and obviously most radicals both don't have the aptitude, but they would eschew something like that out of hand. They would poo-poo it. They would say that that's utterly ridiculous. But, you know, when you talk about a television show that just came out in 2015 called Transparent, now all of a sudden people are talking about trans issues in a much more meaningful and...
That is totally where my head went too. That how did in the space of 5 years or something did mm-hmm. trans people go from being like widely condemned as like bizarre or insane or gross to now it's like something that in significant parts of mainstream America you're supposed to be totally supportive of? It was fucking TV shows.
It was TV
magazine
shows.
Magazine covers.
Yeah, the Wachowski siblings.
I don't even know that.
The people who made The Matrix.
Really?
They used to be two brothers.
Yeah,
one one has come out as trans.
Oh, wow.
They won a big award. I mean, we're talking about The Matrix.
Yeah,
basically, you can now reread The Matrix. You can go back through the craziness of what The Matrix was talking about from a philosophical perspective and talk about the fact that they have now... You can reparse their old movies, and they just put out a TV show this year called, I think, Sense 8 or something, that basically is a crazy pro-trans science fiction story that I couldn't finish. But anyways, the point is that if you're really going to talk about these sort of questions and the ways in which people are separated in North America, you know, the other thing that you would have to talk about is sports. And the fact that, in general, radicals don't want to talk meaningfully about what sports are and what they mean to most people's lives. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, so these are very unpleasant conversations. And they're not the same conversation that is how anarchists like to talk about this sort of thing, which is to basically talk about them in the context of the streets. In other words, in general, the strategic lens that answers this question basically says that the people who we have the most in common with and the people who are most likely to agree with us is some version of someone that you would meet on the streets. But by and large, when you're talking about a place like the Bay Area, the streets, i.e. poor people, are further and further out from the place where radical, cool, hip, urban, bohemian people want to live. And so this conversation has a very clear level of like naivete associated with it that I also think is worth mentioning.
Yeah. And again, I want to come back to the hammer-nail problem of, yeah, that's where the action is. And it, yeah, it just ends up being a sort of recapitulation of how do we identify the revolutionary subject. I mean, the revolutionary subject is, I mean, for a lot of people in this country, is some caricature of a poor black man who just lost his job and is pissed off.
Well, I mean, in the question, they're using the term proletariat, which obviously then, which demonstrates that they're not from North America, because people, very few people use the term proletarian to actually refer to proletarians. But if you're going to be a generous reading of the question, you would say that a proletariat is anyone who, rather than owned means of production, works the means of production. And it, clearly that's the bulk of the population. But to flip it around and to sort of get very theoretically Marxist on this question, very few people associate their personal identity with what it is that they do for income. And people might say, I'm a plumber, I'm a carpenter, I'm a system administrator, but they basically then try to change the subject as quickly as possible to say, but I'm a big Raiders fan, and or I like MMA. In other words, the last thing I want to talk about a stranger with is what I do for fucking work.
Right. And so I think the last dimension of this question that we haven't addressed at the moment was, so they said, how do you see this praxis that you propose and whose contradictory consequences were played out in Greece moving from... Okay, well, we did kind of address that. I guess I did want to get in... I feel like one of the bigger questions was, or a sort of implicit question there was, like, isn't this what you're talking about? Isn't the Greek riots what you're talking about? Because it's people that were inhabiting infrastructure. The infrastructure played a key role. These people had face-to-face interactions with each other, and it was a spontaneous sort of thing that came from desire.
So I would love, and perhaps we're not getting to other things that we wanted to do this episode, but that might be okay, because I think that one part of that question, which is more appropriate to ask us than to ask other people, is that what is the difference between Athens and the Bay Area? Arguably, these are two of the largest radical populations of radical people in the world. And so what's the difference? Mm-hmm. And so one of the differences from my perspective, and obviously I've been to Athens, I assume you haven't been.
I have not been.
So one huge difference is there is a much wider multi-generational range in the Athens and the active Athens radical space, or we would say anarchist space. So that's one. Two, there are a set of rules. We would call Athens is basically a culturally homogenous place. So that's a huge thing that's worth talking about sort of separately. But part of that homogeneity is that almost everybody is of the same economic class. And that is absolutely not true in the radical space here in the Bay Area. There are many people here who are secret upper class people who do not talk about it and are not open about it. But that it does infect their worldview. But it also means that if you're in the anarchist space and you fuck up or you do something that's inappropriate by general cultural values, you'll get your ass whooped. And that almost never happens in the Bay Area. Very few situations, and most of the situations that happen here in the U.S. don't feel like they would be generally socially acceptable. They just mostly seem like people being brats.
Or the conflict is over something that's trivial.
Right. But I definitely heard many stories about members of the anarchist space in Athens getting whooped for doing something wrong and everyone being pretty much okay with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another huge difference is that in Western Europe, that anarchism is already explicitly not of the left, because you have a history of leftist governments in Western Europe that are obviously not coming to the rescue of the people, and so you don't have that same sort of weird inveiglement.
Yeah, it's different, but yeah, that is true. And I guess finally, I mentioned the multi-generational thing, but it also means that there's this history that people very much feel connected to that history and feel like part of that history, and that is one thing I would say that's absolutely not true in North America. I would say that most anarchists in North America don't experience themselves as being part of anything at all. Mm-hmm. And this is why it's so easy for them to no longer do anarchist activities and be anarchists, because there are, for most people, they're not entangled.
Mm-hmm.
So with that said, I basically would say that with all those differences, demonstrating how kind of impossible it is to do the same thing in Athens that we did, to the extent to which it would be possible to do it, I would feel like that is what I'm doing. I'm absolutely involved with, you know, local social center. I'm trying to do publishing projects with that are meaningful, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So imagining a situation that would happen that would mobilize huge sections of sort of the population and the population, I love that idea. It seems like a dream. And when it happened in Athens, it failed for reasons that, you know, are kind of outside the scope of the question. But within the context of the Bay and talking about what this would look like in the Bay, I can't imagine the murder of a child in the Bay summoning so much enthusiasm.
No, no way. No, I mean, we see it happen, of course, but it just takes the form of the sort of typical riot, which is not even a riot, really, more of like an aggressive protest.
Usually it's a march happens.
A march happens where people break some things, and eventually the police stop it. I guess to address the emailer's question that I brought up, when they talk about the role of infrastructure being key and isn't that important, I mean, I would say yes, definitely. I would love to see, I guess you were saying we might touch on this bar thing, more spaces open up and have more face-to-face conversations. And I mean, the reason that I got interested in podcasting, I didn't so much conceptualize it this way to begin with, but it was the idea of I want to talk to people and I want to create a medium through which conversations can happen and that people can, you know, write these thoughtful emails and such. And I do see it as a kind of form of infrastructure. I mean, it's a depleted in the sense that you don't have the same face-to-face or the embeddedness in a particular place, but something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the hope is to have conversations written in neon letters and that the people who can see the shades of neon that you write in, you know, come around you and you do projects and collaborations together. And, you know, as this podcast changes, which it will be changing soon, thinking about what lessons we learned in the first 6 months is going to be an important way to figure out what happens in the next 6 months. I mostly really like this question because it gets a bit more at the heart of, I hate the way in which a lot of nihilism conversations have turned out. There's this conference happening in Victoria in a couple months, and it's framing itself as nihilism.hope. And to me, those two things aren't even on the same trajectory. I mean, I make fun of... in other words, there's a way in which people think that there's some sort of popularity contest going on or...
Between nihilism and hope.
Nihilism and hope.
Yeah.
Which I just think is totally absurd. Of course, I don't necessarily use the term hope particularly frequently, but then again, I do, because, for instance, just now in talking about...
You said that would be beautiful. I would love to see that.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. In other words, like I have things that probably aren't going to happen that I do actively think about and even work towards, but I think that the difference between... nihilism and hope, or like the way that the reason I don't see them on a line or particularly connected, is that hope just seems like a spiritual feeling, and I don't talk about my feelings all that often. whereas nihilism, to me, nihilism infects other things rather than it is its own thing, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean that. Back when we were talking about the episode of Anarchy Radio where Ian Smith and Jerad Bowser were on, one thing that I think I said more than once in the episode is I hate this conflation or this sort of confounding that happens between a particular philosophical perspective or analytical perspective and the assumption that a certain set of actions goes along with it, which I have never found to be the case in my own life. My own sort of personal pessimism about the possibility of an anarchist future in my lifetime has nothing to do with the fact that, or in no way makes me sort of slothful or not want to participate in things.
I think that that's actually about as much time as we have, starting a little early, but I think that what we'll do is we'll maybe do another episode tomorrow. I'm about to go away on a vacation, and since we're hot on this theme already, and so really what we're going to talk about, for those of you who don't pay attention to anarchist news with a great amount of attention, yesterday we, the two of us, were basically we were trolled for hours and hours and hours, and the trolls had these really weird I mean, basically they were homosexual in nature, they were really graphic sexually, and
descriptions of us
and I have no idea to what end, but somewhere in there was an interesting question, which is basically like, and I guess a question that's framed by the existence of it's going down, the website and the project. The question basically is like, how could the two of you think that we, as in the revolutionary movement for total social transformation, how could you possibly think we're so weak when we have so much evidence that we're so strong? And so that was the intention for the theme for this week, but I think that we're going to continue it and talk in some more detail about what is weakness and what that means. Sound good?
That sounds good. Great. Thanks for listening. Thank you.